Well, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here today. I'm going to talk about the, as you can see, the what's called differential equations for Dyson processes. But I thought I would give a little background before I get into that. I talk a little bit about integrable differential equations and how Panleve equations are occurring in probability theory. This audience probably knows less about this than if you know the integrable systems crowd. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes giving some background history on how these types of differential equations are coming into probability theory. Then I'll go through the Dyson-Brownian motion. Kurt defined this yesterday, but I'll repeat a few things he said, and talk about the Airy process, which is a limiting case of Dyson-Brownian motion. And then the subject of the talk will be these differential equations. I apologize, that's quite technical, so that's why I've tried to save it for the end. And then at the last, I'd like to talk about some future directions and open problems. Well, actually, we're used to having integrable differential equations in probability theory. If one wanted to sort of logically define the Gaussian distribution from a differential equations point of view, this is how we do it. And so we would say the distribution function is given in terms of a solution to an integrable differential equation. Of course, this maybe begs the question a bit in the sense that, let me see how this works. I'm using this word integrable differential equation, and I haven't really defined the word integrable, so it's reasonable to ask what exactly is an integrable differential equation. I think everyone would agree this is one of them, but what is the general definition? So this requires you to understand what we mean by integrable. Well, I have to say that I'm not really going to answer that. There's people write books on these things. Give you, I mean, there's two well-known concepts. The first concept, which won't be here, is the familiar concept from Hamiltonian dynamics of Arnold-Louville integrability. That's a precisely defined the concept of what it means to be an integrable differential equation. Another class of integrable differential equations, and the ones we'll be talking about today, they arise as integrability conditions for linear problems. And so that's going to be a theme, that the nonlinear equations that we look at are associated with some linear operator. There's some linear problem underlying it. And it's because there's an underlying linear problem, it makes the analysis of these nonlinear differential equations possible. Now, suppose you are in the fortunate position that you have an equation of this form where this D is some exterior differentiation with respect to a number of different variables. And so this is a linear differential equation. It's total. By total, I mean there's an equation for every derivative. Now, this omega is a matrix of one forms. Well, you can't just have any omega there, because of D squared being zero, there's a compatibility condition. And so those matrix elements themselves would have to satisfy some sort of nonlinear differential equation. So this nonlinear differential equation is intimately related to a linear problem. And the classic examples of this type of nonlinearity are the six Panleve equations. And so let me describe in a few words how some of these Panleve equations arose. This is a classic subject in differential equations. Surprisingly, it's not in many books, though. So imagine you have a Fuchsian differential equation. So this means this is a matrix equation, so these are matrices. The A's are matrices. And the singularities of this differential equation are at these points A sub nu. Now, this is a Fuchsian, meaning all the singularities are regular singular points. And one knows, of course, that if you have a singularity, like here's an A nu, and you take this Y sub Z, and you analytically continue it about this, then this y sub z goes to y times m sub gamma, where gamma is there. Because if you take a solution, a basis of solutions, and you analytically continue them, the analytic continuation is a solution. So this has to come back to some multiple of itself, and this m sub gamma is called the monodromy matrix associated with that contour gamma. It was asked by Schlesinger in the early part of the 20th century, how, imagine moving the location of these singularities, and you want to do it in such a way that these, all these monodromy matrices, they of course generate a group, that as you move the A's, these monodromy matrices don't change. In general, if you change the location of the singularity, the monodromy will change. And so for this to happen, this requires that these matrices in this Fuchsian differential equation are a function of this location. And one, of course, when I say one extends, this is really the theorem of Schlesinger when I say that, using the fact that these are the monodromy is independent of the location of the singularities allows one to take this ordinary differential equation and extend it to a system of differential equations where now D is exterior differentiation with respect to the Z and the A nus. So you build into the fact that when you differentiate with respect to the A nus, there's no, the monodromy is remains constant. So now if you write down the integrability conditions for this matrix, omega, this is what's called the Schlesinger equations in integrable systems. And these are nonlinear differential equations for these matrices A. They're quite complicated. I won't bother to write them down. They're still being, the solutions to that, it's still a topic of research. There's lots of papers still being written on that. If you take the simplest example of this, well, the simplest example is when you have three singularities at 0, 1, and infinity, but then that's the hypergeometric function. So if you go one beyond that, you have four regular singular points, and you can, by linear fractional transformations, you can put three of them at 0, 1, and infinity. And so T is the only variable. And if you take the simplest case of a 2x2 matrix, then these Schlesinger equations, which are those integrability conditions, reduce to Panleve 6. So the Panleve function, the way you should think about it, in this point of view, is that it's the integrability condition for a certain isomonodromy problem. In fact, there are six Panleve equations, and they can all be viewed from these isomonodromy considerations. The other five require that we have irregular singular points, and so the discussion there is more complicated because the monodromy data also involves Stokes multipliers. And so, but this has been worked out over the years, and so it's a very clear, in fact, the paper by Miwa, Jimbo, and Ueno have a very clear discussion of the relationship between isomonodromy and these Panleve equations. I should say that Panleve himself actually didn't arrive at these equations from this point of view. He asked us a different question. He said, well, imagine you have a second-order differential equation, and think of this as a rational function of the first derivative w and the independent variable z. And he wanted to study this class of nonlinear differential equations, which have a certain property. Well, we call this property the Panleve property now. Namely, that as you change the initial conditions of your solution, the only movable singularities are poles. And we all know from, you know, simple differential equations, like if you write down dy dx equals y squared in a calculus class, and you solve that by separating variables, then the integration constant, there's a solution has a pole, and it depends upon the integration constant. Yeah, thanks. So it's when you study nonlinear differential equations, it's too much to ask that all the singularities are fixed, but you could ask that you allow the movable singularities to be poles. And Panleve classified the types of differential equations which have this property. And then you can find the list in that old Dover book by Ince on ordinary differential equations, and there are like 50 of them listed there. There are 50. It's a horrendous calculation. I mean, for example, the classification for third order is still open. It's just such a horrendous problem of calculation that there are people working on various bits and pieces of it. But you can look up, and in this classification, actually, it was finished by Gambier. And there are basically, on that 50, there are 44 which are, quote, known in the sense of it could be reduced to things that people knew before. And there are 6 which are essentially new. They define essentially new transcendental functions. There's a preciseness to that, and it's called the irreducibility property. And these 6 new types are now called the Panleve equations. So, and they had many, these Panleve equations have many nice properties. You can solve nonlinear connection problems, which normally in a nonlinear differential equation, there's no way to solve a connection problem. But with you can solve that. And these turn out to be important in applications. And I won't say anything about this, but it's extremely important that these are all closely related to Riemann-Hilbert problems. And so you can use the methods of Riemann-Hilbert methods to analyze these Panleve equations. Okay. Well, Panleve equations in probability theory have a fair history. The first example came up in the two-dimensional easing model with the work of T.T. Wu and his co-authors. And there, the two-point scaling functions in the massive regime were expressed in terms of a Panleve 3 function. I should mention, and this is the note down here, that there's an alternative representation of these correlation functions, and they're expressed in either terms of Toeplitz determinants or Fredholm determinants. And so this was in the first case where you found a relationship between what we would call determinant correlations and these integrable differential equations. In random matrix theory, they have first appeared in work with Jimbo, Miwa, Mori, and Sato in 1980, where in the Gaussian unitary ensemble, and when you take what's called the bulk scaling, so you're looking in the center of the near the center of the spectrum, and you're letting the size of the matrices tend to infinity, and a natural question which to ask, and it went back to Wigner, is if you take an interval of length s, to ask what is the probability that you find no eigenvalues in that interval. And Goldon, about 1960, showed that, I should say, Wigner made a guess for what that answer should be. And physicists to this day still use that. The approximation is good to about 1% or better. So it still gets used a lot in numerical work. But Goldon was the first to actually write down what this distribution function was, namely the probability that an interval of length s has no eigenvalues, sometimes called a gap probability. And he expressed that in terms of a certain Fredholm determinant. It looked like I minus a certain operator. But Jimbo, Miwa, Mori, and Sato in 1980 showed that, in fact, this could be expressed in terms of what's called one of these Panleve functions. And if you look at all three of these ensembles, the Gaussian orthogonal, Gaussian unitary, and Gaussian symplectic, if you look at the distribution of the largest eigenvalue, there's also a Panleve function which describes the distribution function. And I've given you one formula in here. Here's an actual formula of all this. If you ask for the distribution of the largest eigenvalue in the Gaussian unitary ensemble, there's a certain scaling limit here. There's a certain function which will play a role in this talk. I'm calling here psi, and it satisfies this differential equation. So if this term weren't here, that would be the familiar area equation, And this is a special case of Pavlovec 2. It's on his list. And we're looking for the solution to this differential equation, which is asymptotic to the carry function. It's known that there's a unique solution to that. Yeah. Now the Pavlovec functions were Well, you know, that's the work of Sato, Milwa, and Jimbo answered that question in the easing model. And they there is isomonodromy in the easing model. It's harder to find in the probabilistic setting, and it would be interesting to be able to identify that. It's something for future work, but it, just to say a word, in the easing model, it's that underlying the easing model is a Dirac operator. And so one looked at solutions to the Dirac operator on certain punctured domains. And one, by looking at certain commutator relationships associated with the easing and disorder fields, you could see that you had to be looking at isomonodromy solutions. So it was Sato, Milwa, Jimbo who introduced the isomonodromy picture into probability theory. And that needs to be developed more in this random matrix theory. It turns out that the techniques that Harold and I developed are a lot easier in some sense. They're more based on operator theory. But this gives you a conceptual understanding of why to expect it ahead of time. Okay, so, I just mentioned here that the in this F, for this Gaussian unitary ensemble, it's given by a Fredholm determinant, and I'll define this operator in a minute, but it was mentioned briefly in Kurt's talk. It's this so-called area operator. I didn't prepare a transparency on this, but I'd like to make one remark that to follow up on what Kurt was saying yesterday, is that these methods are clearly methods from integrable systems, and in Kurt's talk, you could in some sense say the RSK is playing the role of the integrable part of the because it gives you very specific formulas, and because of that, one is required to look at specific distributions. In Kurt's talk yesterday, there was a requirement that it be the geometric distribution on his thing. And in this case, so these integral systems, you might worry and that they're so special that they don't, the more general cases are not going to be given by this. And Kurt argued yesterday that one expects that that's not the case. But there, in random matrix theory, there's one very strong result that gives belief to this. And that's a result due to Alexander Soshnikov. And that's, if you look at a real symmetric matrix, and you put the entries in IID, sort of the independent ones, say, on the diagonal and above, it's only in the case that if that distribution is Gaussian, is the measure an invariant measure, invariant under orthogonal transformations. Now, it's the invariant measures that have this integrable system approach. There's an underlying Riemann-Hilbert problem. All this technology applies to the invariant measures. To the non-invariant measures, these methods do not apply. So, in some sense, the Wigner case is like a non-integrable case. But Soshnikov's theorem is that, at least for the largest eigenvalue, the limit theorems are the same as you get in these integrable cases. So that's a theorem, and it's strongly suggestive of the fact that there's a lot of universality going on. So, okay. Okay, so that brief tour of what integrable differential equations, I'll review Dyson's Brownian motion. And as Kurt said yesterday, we imagine that we have a Hermitian matrix. We're looking at finite size matrices to start with. And the independent matrix elements undergo Ornstein-Uhlenbeck diffusion. So we have some process on matrices, and we imagine starting the process off with the initial conditions are the GUE initial conditions. For that case, it's known what the transition density, it goes back to Ornstein and Uhlenbeck in the one-dimensional case, and you can, this is, and so the transition density from H to H prime, from times, you start at time tau 1 to going to tau 2, is given by this expression. And you should notice that if you let the larger time tend to infinity, this Q tends to zero, so that term goes away, that term goes away. And so the equilibrium measure is the Gaussian unitary ensemble. I just mentioned that in this picture, each eigenvalue feels an electric field, if you want to use this language, that this is, of course, due to the linear restoring term in Ornstein-Uhlenbeck, but you get this extra interaction, and that's what makes the eigenvalues highly dependent. Now, if you go to many times, so we want to look at this many times, and if we look with GU initial conditions, the density then, of course, it's a Markov process, so we just take the product of the transitions, and there's the initial density. Now, this is a measure on the matrices, and as John was talking about this yesterday, and this is an example of a multi-matrix model. But from this point of view, we're not thinking of it as a multi-matrix model. We're just thinking of it as the in this Brownian motion picture. Now, the standard idea is this is the measure on the matrices. You want the measure induced on the eigenvalues. And so you take each of these Hermitian matrices, and you imagine writing it in diagonal form. So you take each matrix Hj, and you diagonalize it. And then you want to integrate out these unitary matrices. Now, fortunately, in the Hermitian case, you can do that. There's something, and John mentioned it yesterday, the Harishonda, Isaacson, and Zuber integral allows one to integrate out these unitary parts and left with an induced measure on the eigenvalues. And this leads to what are called these extended kernels. This was mentioned briefly. This was mentioned by John yesterday. And Einard and Maeder were the first to do it, and then Kurt and Prepelfer and Sloan and others. And by scaling of these kernels, you're led to these various, what we call extended kernels. So let's see. There. So let's define what the Airy process is. So the Airy process is, Kurt mentioned yesterday, we take the Dyson-Brownian motion, and we're looking at the largest eigenvalue, and it's changing with time now. And so we're going to scale that largest eigenvalue. And, of course, you've got to normalize it properly to get a limit. But when you do, we're going to call the resulting process this A of tau. And it's going to be defined by these finite dimensional distribution functions. And so I'll write down the formulas for that here. So this probability is expressed as a Fredholm determinant of what we now call this extended Airy kernel. So what is this extended Airy kernel? So you have m different times, and so we're going to form a matrix of size m by m, a matrix kernel, and its entries are given by, well, this formula where you see there are two Airy functions, that's hence the name Airy kernel, and then this is where the time dependence comes in. That's when I is greater than j, and similar down here. And so this probability, this right here, is given by this Fredholm determinant. Okay, so that is a formal definition of the Airy process in terms of its distributions. Now, let me make some remarks about that extended Airy kernel. The first one is, well, when you put m equals to 1, it does reduce to the, see, I could use the lights on this one. When m is 1, there's no exponential factor, and you have this written down, and this is how I think Kurt wrote it down yesterday. You can write this as now, the reason I've done that is that when it's in this form, it's what Alexander Itz and his colleagues have called an integrable kernel. In general, an integrable kernel is going to look like have some function phi, some matrix, another monk, phi of x, psi of y, where x minus y. So when m is 1, it reduces in this, what's called in this literature, an integrable kernel. And there's a complete theory now for kernels of this form. And we understand if you have a Fredholm determinant whose kernel looks like that, and there's some conditions on the phi and psi, they satisfy certain differential equations. There's a general theory now of how you associate a corresponding integrable differential equation for it. That's about 10 years old now. However, I should remark, and that's the important remark, is that when m is greater than 1, in other words, when we're looking at more than one time, this kernel with that little, remember, when it's when you have times in it, there's this exponential factor here. It doesn't fit into this framework. So this extended area kernel and these other kernels don't fit into our standard framework, and so we don't have this standard machinery to apply. I'm just reiterating the fact that when m is 1, this Fredholm determinant is related to this panel of acceleration. That's what I already said. Here's a precise relationship between the panel of A function and this operator. Is if you take this area operator, this is m equals 1, so you take this operator right here, whose kernel is given right here, and you apply it to the area function and you evaluate that at the endpoint, the resulting function you get satisfies panel of A too. So it was natural for the people who introduced this, Prepelfer and Spohn and Kurt Johansson, to conjecture that for m greater than 1, there should be underlying integrable differential equations. And this was recently answered that, yes, there are, and the question is, what are they, by Mark Adler and Pierre van Merbeke and Harold Wittem and myself. And so what I'd like to talk about is those equations. So now, unfortunately, here comes a little of the technical part. So this is going to be this extended area kernel, K, right here. And we're going to introduce the resolving kernel. And it's a standard fact. Remember, these C's are we're looking at the probability. So just the notation here, remind you, is the probability that A of tau 1 is less than or equal to C1 up to A of tau M is less than or equal to Cm. So that is this Fredholm determinant. And we're interested in seeing what we can do with that object. Okay. It's a standard fact that if you take the logarithm of this determinant, differentiate it with respect to the C sub k's, what you're looking at is this resolvent operator, the kernel of that, on the diagonal, evaluated at those points. So this tells you want to look at this resolvent operator. Okay, so what? So it's reasonable then some of our unknowns are going to be this resolvent kernel, and so there's going to be a matrix which size m by m, and they're evaluated at these points ci and cj. Now remember, in the m equals 1 case, we applied that operator to the Airy function and got the panel of A function. Here, well, we just make a diagonal matrix whose diagonal entries are Airy functions, and we take and apply the same object for m greater than 1 to this. Now these are matrices now. And so before, when we took this capital Q and evaluated it at these endpoints, those were the panel of A functions. So what we should do here is we should take this matrix, evaluate it at C sub I, and we get these little matrices Q sub ij. Unfortunately, because things don't commute, there's going to be tildes on everything, so I won't. It doubles the number of unknowns. Also, we have to introduce a Q prime. Now, by prime there, I mean this is a function of x, so you take its derivative with respect to x, and then you evaluate that at ci. So this prime is not a derivative of anything. It's just to denote that it came from something. And so you have to introduce something like that. And so what are the equations? Well, the equations, they're best written if you write them in exterior differential form, is by d now, I mean exterior differentiation with respect to these points. So these are these points right here. So we have a dr, that's one of our unknowns. A q is our unknown. This q is what might be called an analog of the Panleve function. So it's a matrix analog of that. And they look fairly complicated. And if you stare at them for a moment, you'll notice that actually there's an rx and an ry in here, and there's no equations for the rx and the ry. So they don't look like they're closed. In fact, that's one of the problems of the analysis of these. What is this rx and ry? Well, if you take this resolvent operator and differentiate it with respect to the first variable x and then set it ci, that's what we mean by rx and similarly ry. Now, it turns out that these are not unknowns. So as they stand, these equations aren't closed. And so we have to figure out how to relate. We have to have a relationship between these rx, rys, and what we called our unknown things. And this is where you notice also, if you go back, you also notice there's no time in any of these equations. I should say the derivation of those equations is not too difficult. If those who are familiar with the proof of the m equals 1 case, it follows along the same lines as that proof. However, what is required is we have to find some information about these rx's and ry's. And here's where we have to use something very specific about the Airy operator. And this is that operator, which is that Airy kernel. And this is just saying it satisfies the Airy equation. And this is a simple computation of D is differentiation. I don't know if I didn't say that. D is the operator of differentiation. And this, we have to make use of this very specific piece of information. And then we can derive some conditions which determine the Rx and Ry in terms of the unknowns. So this is some sort of algebraic condition that we get. Well, when m is 1, of course, all these equations reduce to the single Panleve 2 equation, as you would expect. So let me make some remarks about these equations. Mark Adler and Pierre van Mierbrugge they have a system of differential equations which are somewhat different than ours. In fact, the relationship between the two is unclear at this moment. But they use them to derive and Harold Widom from the Fredholm determinant also derived the same expansion. That if you look at the probability, so it's a stationary process, so we put one of the times to be zero, and we'll look at the probability that at time zero it's less than or equal to C1, and time tau it's less than or equal to C2. Now when tau goes to infinity, you would expect that to be the product of those two probabilities. You would expect it to factorize. So we'll divide out the probability of each one of those individually. And so you would expect some sort of expansion. Of course, exactly what powers here you have to work out. But you would expect some sort of expansion. Now, one of the results of this and shows where integrable systems is quite useful, it would be important to get a handle on these coefficients. This is particularly so in comparing, if you look at numerical work in the physics literature, they can get some information in Monte Carlo studies about these coefficients and things. So it would be useful to have a prediction for what these are. The important point I want to emphasize is this integrable systems allows you to give explicit formulas for these C2, C4, and as many as you want. And they're explicitly expressed in terms of the underlying Pavlovsky 2 function. In other words, in this large tau limit, this is factorizing, but all these coefficients, there's not a general proof that the nth term could do this, but it looks like it will happen. For example, this coefficient right here is given in terms of this Pavlovsky function. And that's important in the sense that if you want numbers out of this, this is the only way you're going to get it. There's no way to calculate these coefficients in any other way. So this is the one application of those differential equations. These same methods of perturbation theory show you that I called this a matrix Pavlovsky function. This gives you a sense in which, as you look at the large tau expansion, it's a decoupling into these scalar Pavlovsky functions, and then you're getting these off diagonal terms. So one, this Q is going to play a role in these higher order things. Now, there's unfortunately, we have the equations, but we don't have much in the way of analysis of the equations. The equations themselves are quite difficult to analyze. But there's some general questions. The way we derived the equations was not from an isomonodromy problem. And so it would be very nice to know whether there's an underlying isomonodromy problem. And is the Fredholm determinant of this extended area kernel, is it the tau function in the sense of Jimbo, Miwa, and Ueno? This would be very important, I think, to understand. And to see that, our equations that we wrote down, when I first talked about integrability conditions, I said they came from a linear problem. Well, of course, we have a linear problem, but it's not in the sense of the dw equals omega w, which I wrote down. It would be nice to see that our equations come as some sort of integrability condition. I suspect they do. It's just that the way our proof doesn't really tell us how to get that. So this would be, of course, our equations have to be compatible because they come from solutions of this Fredholm determinant, but actually trying to show that on an algebraic level is quite messy, and Harold wrote a MAPLE program that showed it for small m, but it was we don't have a conceptual proof of that. The difficulty lies that these conditions determining the Rx and Ry make it difficult to prove the integrability. That if I just differentiate, if you have a system of equations and you have an equation for every derivative, then the mixed partials have to be the same. That's surprisingly hard to show for this system, even though we know they have to be compatible because they came from this Fredholm determinant. So it's not a question of that our solution isn't compatible. There's no issue there. It's just that normally you would expect a simple algebraic proof of that fact. It would just follow from the equations themselves. The difficulty lies, as I say, that these conditions of determining the Rx and Ry are hard to handle. This last thing is more for application use in the growth model literature, but it would be useful to systematize the large tau asymptotics, because that might be the only way you're going to get some good numerics, and couple that. We still don't know how to do a small tau expansion in these equations. They're quite singular at that point. But it would be nice to be able to do these, and that would be useful in the growth processes, because this would provide explicit information about these things. Okay. I just mentioned that we took in the area kernel, Dyson-Brownian motion, we scaled at the largest eigenvalue to get the Hermite kernel. You could imagine just keeping things finite and working with the extended Hermite kernel. And there's a Fredholm determinant, and you could ask if there are differential equations in that case. The answer is yes. You could do bulk scaling, there's one, and there's something called the extended Breslau. They are all more complicated than the area system, so I'm not going to write them down. Unfortunately, we don't have a general theory like we have, like in this, in the equilibrium theory, all the kernels are of this form, and we have a general theory which tells you what to do. In each of these cases, we have to come up with a special trick. It's the analog of those commutator relations that involve the area kernel. So this, each one has to be proved separately, and you're not sure that you can, you know, the proof looks similar, but it involves finding some identity. So we don't have a general theory here like we have in the equilibrium theory. So that's certainly, and I mentioned Adler and Van Merwijk also have these differential equations for extended term. Yeah, and these will be the differential equations for them. So I am bothered to write those out to see. So I'd like to conclude with a couple remarks. As Kurt pointed out in his lecture, you can start with many, many different discrete models, and when you scale them, you end up with this area kernel, or if you're looking at the process version, you end up with this extended area kernel. And basically, the reason that happens, if you look at the details of the proof, this area kernel rises as a fold singularity. The area function, if you look at the Arnold-Michael Berry point of view of classification of singularities, the area function is the diffraction integral associated with a fold singularity. And the reason you're getting this area function, and the reason you're getting this one-third, once you're at this level of the singularity analysis, it's because of this coalescence of two saddle points, and the one-third is coming from the n cubed in the fold singularity. Well, of course, you can go back, and I was noticing there's Michael Berry and Arnold are on the wall here. You can go back and you can look up in Michael Berry's lectures or Arnold's lectures, and of course, there's the whole classification of singularities. And the next one on the list is a what's called a cusp singularity. This was studied in the physics literature by Percy in the 1940s, a cusp singularity in electromagnetic scattering. I like to say now there are three Percys in this field, and they're all spelled differently. But there is now, instead of an area kernel, there's a Percy kernel. It's going to be a higher order singularity. Instead of a coalescence of two saddle points, this is going to be one of these higher universality classes. It's going to correspond to, it does correspond to a cusp singularity, and mathematically you see it arising as the coalescence of three saddle points. And the Percy kernel is expressed in terms of, well, the Percy functions, just like there's an Airy function. And the Airy function was the diffraction integral for the fold singularity. The Percy function is the diffraction integral associated with the cusp singularity. I'm cheating a little bit on the contour there, but that's roughly the idea. And so now we have this, and this is fairly recent by these different authors here. So the general problem, and this is what people are thinking about now in the field, is imagine you go to Arnold's table, and he will, you can, all these exponents, one-third and so on, are on that table. You have a singularity. There's a way to associate a diffraction integral to it. So that would be the thing that plays for all the area function, the Percy function, and so on. Well, we don't really know. At this point, it's still a little vague because there's lots of different contour choices, so we don't really know how to go from here. We know how to write down the diffraction integral, but in these problems, the it's not just the diffraction integral, but there are various contour choices that are associated with these diffraction integrals. And then we would like to have, and we don't have this yet, we would like to have a sort of a canonical prescription that, given this singularity, how we associate this kernel to it. So we know the Airy and the Percy, we have these two examples, but in general, we'd like to, given as, say, a general AN singularity, we'd like to be able to have a canonical way of associating one of these kernels to it. So it would be the general, so this would be the a case of a fold singularity? What would be the general way to do that? We don't have a canonical way to do that yet. And then once you have this kernel, that would be the equilibrium theory, there should be an underlying process associated with each one of these singularities. And so, you know, you can expect to hear in the future people talking about Percy processes and the general AN processes. So that's where the field is at this moment. Thank you for your attention.